Hello there. Today is Tuesday, December 24th, Christmas Eve, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, ominous new signs coming out of North Korea.
They can't go back to what they did in 2017, and they launched those ICBMs and more nuclear tests and so forth, because that'll bring China and the U.S. together again. He can't do that.
For the first time since 1803, the iconic Notre Dame Cathedral in France will have no Christmas mass. Also ahead, 2019 was the year climate change was on the music agenda. It's all on today's International Edition. A new satellite image of a factory where North Korea makes military equipment used to launch long-range missiles shows the construction of a new structure. The release of several images from Planet Labs comes amid concern North Korea could launch a rocket or missile as it seeks concessions in stalled nuclear negotiations with the U.S. North Korea has warned that a Christmas gift it gives the U.S. depends on what action Washington takes. One of the new satellite images taken December 19th shows the March 16th factory near Pyongyang, where North Korea manufactures trucks used as mobile launchers for its long-range missiles. Joining us now to discuss is Leszek Buzinski, Honorary Professor of Strategic and Defense Studies Center at the Australian National University. Sir, thank you so much for being with us. What do you make of all of this?
Look at the broader picture. North Korea is rather hemmed in at the moment. Kim Jong-un had two summits with your President Trump, and the last one was, of course, a disaster. And what they want to do is to press the U.S. into an agreement. And from our perspective here in Australia, we note that the North was very concerned about the possibility of a military strike. Back in 2017 in Washington, perhaps this idea wasn't taken that seriously because of the security implications and the effect upon the Korean Peninsula. But we believe that the North Koreans took this very seriously, and so did the Chinese. So Xi Jinping pressed the North, agreed to very tough sanctions on the North, and Kim Jong-un was obliged to enter these summits, and his objective was to have those sanctions imposed by both China and the U.S. in 2017, to have them lifted. He hasn't succeeded in that task, so what he wants to do is to place pressure upon the U.S. as we see it, hoping that bullied presidents such as your president at the moment, who's recently been impeached, hopefully that he may reach out for some kind of foreign policy triumph and agree to lift some of those sanctions. That seems to be the aim. Now, the whole point is that they can't go back to what they did in 2017, and they launched those ICBMs and more nuclear tests and so forth, because that'll bring China and the U.S. together again. He can't do that, but he wants to do a more low-key strategy, firing, for example, multiple missile launches, engaging in threats and so forth, hoping that the United States will respond as we see it.
What do you expect North Korea to do, and do you expect them to do something, as they're saying, some sort of, as they called it, a Christmas present, which everyone is expecting to be some sort of potential test?
Very unlikely at this moment, because this will simply tighten the noose around their necks. The Chinese don't want the North Koreans to do that. And Xi Jinping, he holds the noose in his hand. And I think in the past, it seems to us from our interpretation of Chinese policy that the Chinese let the North Koreans go far too far in the development of their nuclear capability for reasons I won't have time to explain. But now it seems to us that the Chinese are very concerned about the effects of North Korea's nuclear tests and its ICBM launchings back in 2007. They're concerned about the effects upon the United States and their relationship with the U.S. and the Japanese response and the South Korean response, because it upsets their policy. It undermines their policy towards Northeast Asia. So they would be concerned, as we understand it, to rein in the North Koreans and to bridle Kim Jong-un so he won't go too far. So he can't do what he did in the past, resort to nuclear tests or ICBM launching. So he has to adopt something low-key, hoping that will people in Washington will respond.
So you really don't think anything's going to happen?
Not the kind of missile launchings and nuclear tests that we saw back in 2017. A very negative effect on his policy.
Where do you think things are headed ultimately in the longer term Do you think Kim Jong-un, as you mentioned earlier, that the President Trump is looking for a win, that the North Korean leader is keenly aware of U.S. President's need for some sort of win, so he will look to capitalize on that? And will he be able to?
Yes, that's our interpretation of the summits. The North Koreans expected President Trump to be looking for some kind of public relations triumph. That's the way they rate him, and they went into the Hanoi summit thinking that Trump will play ball with them and to agree to lift some of those sanctions and so forth. Well, he didn't. He's thoroughly unpredictable as far as they're concerned. So that's what they're hoping. Now, the other factors that we have to take into account here, China and Russia, they're pressing the Americans to have some of those sanctions lifted, and this relates to their long-term policy, and this is the question you asked, that they hope that the Americans will agree to lift some of those sanctions and to start the ball rolling in terms of staged denuclearization, which has some support on your side. I notice that there are voices from within the State Department calling for this, a return to staged denuclearization. And this has a long history in dealing with North Korea.
Leszek Buzinski, honorary professor at the Strategic and Defense Study Center at the Australian National University. Saudi Arabia on Monday sentenced five people to death and three others to jail over the murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi in Istanbul in October of last year. As VOA's Ardita Dunalari reports, the trial and the ensuing sentencing took place in total secrecy and have exonerated high-level Saudi operatives, but done little to satisfy the calls for justice in the murder of the Washington Post journalist.
The Saudi deputy public prosecutor announced Monday the conclusion of the trial of the 11 suspects charged in connection with journalist Jamal Khashoggi's murder. He stated that the killing was not premeditated and occurred at the spur of the moment. The statement follows the long-held Saudi position that there was no conspiracy to kill the Washington Post journalist, who was murdered in October 2018 while visiting the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. International media advocacy groups condemned the proceedings as a mock trial.
That does not satisfy at all the justice we want to see happening in Khashoggi, and our demand, not just to hold those responsible of the killing, that we go to the highest level of the Saudi government.
A small number of diplomats, including from Turkey, as well as members of Khashoggi's family, were allowed to attend the nine court sessions in Riyadh, although independent media were barred. The foreign diplomats were sworn to secrecy, doing little to address concerns of transparency and accountability in the trial. Jamal Khashoggi was a vocal critic of the Saudi royal family. Details of his death, captured by surveillance of Turkish intelligence services, raised serious questions about the connection between the operatives who committed the murder and Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. He denies involvement in the killing. Saud al-Qahtani, one of the defendants in the Khashoggi murder trial, was a former close aide to the Saudi royal court. He was believed to be the mastermind of the Khashoggi murder. In the end, he was acquitted of all charges.
Yes, an investigation was conducted by the general prosecution. A charge was placed against him, and the court ruled for his release due to lack of evidence to convict him in this case.
The UN Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Execution, Agnes Callamard, authored a report on the Khashoggi case. She decried the trial as a mockery and an antithesis of justice. In a tweet Monday, the UN official blamed both the political repression, corruption, and abuse of power in Saudi Arabia, as well as international complicity, for what she called impunity for the killing of a journalist. Khashoggi's remains have never been found. The U.S. has imposed sanctions on 17 Saudis suspected of involvement in the murder. U.S. President Donald Trump condemned the killing, but has stood by the prince and defended ties with Saudi Arabia. Ardita Dunelari, VOA News, Washington.
Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan says thousands of Syrian refugees are heading to the Turkish border, escaping the Damascus-led offensive in Idlib, the last rebel enclave. Erdogan warns Turkey can no longer accommodate any more refugees, and he will send new arrivals to Europe. My colleague Kate Pound-Dawson spoke with reporter Dorian Jones in Istanbul about it.
Well, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is warning that around 80,000 Syrian refugees in the enclave of Idlib are heading towards the Turkish frontier. They're escaping the bombardment by Damascus-led regime forces backed by Russian air power. They've been launching an offensive against the rebels, and Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has said he's committed to retaking all of Syrian territory, and Idlib has been a priority for him. This area is home for around 3 million people, of which half are believed to be refugees fleeing the conflict from other parts of the country. A third of that 3 million are believed to be children, and a major humanitarian crisis is looming.
Now, what is President Erdogan asking other countries to do to help with this situation, to help with these refugees?
Well, President Erdogan's message has been unequivocal. He's saying that this isn't just a problem for Turkey, this is a problem for the whole region, and in particular Europe. He's been scathing of European countries for failing to, what he said, share the burden of this refugee crisis. Turkey is the world's record holder for the number of refugees, well over 3.5 million. He said that's cost the country nearly $40 billion. And he said they've only received a few billion from Europe. He said that's by far not enough. He said that they haven't shared this burden in terms of sharing the numbers, and particularly not sharing in financial support. Now, he is warning that if there is another major exodus into Turkey, he says that he will open the frontiers of Turkey to Europe and allow these people to enter into seek refuge in across Europe. Now, if you recall, this is not an empty threat. In 2015, around 1 million refugees left Turkey to neighboring Greece. Most of those were Syrian refugees, and that not only caused a humanitarian crisis in Greece, but had major repercussions, politically, socially, all across Europe. And Brussels is very aware that they do not want to face another refugee crisis. So this threat from Erdogan will be taken very seriously.
Now, also, we have Turkish diplomats meeting with Russian officials. What's going on there?
Well, this is key, I think, for Ankara to try and avert this latest humanitarian crisis that is believed to be looming. Now, while Turkey and Russia back opposite sides in the Syrian civil war, Ankara, the Turkish president, Erdogan, has developed a very good relationship with the Russian president, Vladimir Putin. They have been cooperating in Syria in some ways to bring an end to this conflict. And those cooperation as part of a much wider rapprochement between these two countries to the scale that many of Turkey's Western allies are very alarmed at what they see as this drift towards Russia, and particularly in NATO, and in particular concerns are held in Washington over this. Now, Ankara will be looking to that relationship to avert another crisis.
Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Boeing has fired its CEO to hopefully restore confidence amid the 737 MAX crisis. The U.S. confirms a report citing Iran officials as saying 1,500 people were killed in protests in that country. Zimbabwe is facing a Christmas woes as an economy struggles, and the inescapable effects of global warming jeopardize livelihoods in Africa. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. In 2019 began with cheers at the U.S. Capitol as a record number of women, as well as ethnic and religious minority members, were sworn in as lawmakers. But as 435 representatives and 100 senators got down to work, polarized politics regularly stalled progress in the politically divided Congress, which ended the year consumed by impeachment of President Donald Trump. VOA's Carolyn Pursuti reports, even with impeachment proceedings, Congress ended the year with a sudden flurry of significant legislative action.
The year 2019 started, or maybe we should say stalled, for Congress with a government shutdown. It lasted a record 35 days, shocking new legislators, like California Democrat Katie Porter, who got a crash course in Washington politics.
There was no warm-up period. We arrived on January 3rd. We were sworn in, and within a matter of hours, we were voting on bills to reopen the government.
But the government would stay closed until late January, delaying the president's annual State of the Union address until February.
We can bridge old divisions, heal old wounds, build new coalitions.
That sentiment rarely proves true when one party, in this case the Democrats, holds the majority in the House, and the other party, the Republicans, holds the majority in the Senate. Caprica Faro is a former Ohio State senator, now a college professor, who spoke to VOA on Skype.
Everybody's pointing the finger at the other person, and what we're seeing as a result is gridlock and not a whole lot of movement in regards to policy matters that I think Americans were hoping to see move.
Through mid-December, for all of 2019, Congress passed 90 bills that became law, logging one of the least productive years in modern history. Of the total, many dealt with minor matters, like renaming U.S. post offices or routine government operations.
As the Lucas Lowe Memorial Post Office.
Stalled this year were bills on immigration, health care, and, again, Stephen Billett.
The fact that they're sitting there and not moving is reflective of the differences in philosophy. And again, the divisions that we see in this country manifest themselves in our Congress. And of course, everybody has their eyes on the next election.
Gridlock is not new to Capitol Hill and typically worsens as elections draw near. Even so, Congress recently engineered a notable exception. Amid all the distractions of the House's impeachment hearings targeting President Trump,
no president is supposed to be a dictator in the United States.
Congressional leaders negotiated an agreement with the White House to pass the USMCA, a massive trade deal between the United States, Mexico, and Canada. Michelle Swerz teaches at Georgetown University.
He is still the president, and if you want to move policy, you have to work with the president. So politicians are able to compartmentalize, maybe easier than other people, and they know that they need to move this legislation forward. Because
stalled this year were bills on immigration, health care, and
probably something on gun control.
Several international bills did become law, including a bill promoting human rights and self-determination in Hong Kong, prompting House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to say,
"We're grateful that the president has signed that legislation."
Another law prohibits the sale of military equipment to the Hong Kong Police Department. Additionally, the Uyghur Human Rights Act passed both chambers and is awaiting the president's signature. New Jersey Republican Chris Smith.
So the cultural genocide and the atrocities suffered by the Uyghurs and others in China.
Efforts to prohibit the sale of military equipment to Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, England, France, Spain, and Italy all failed due to presidential vetoes, as did an effort to end America's involvement in Saudi Arabia's military campaign in Yemen. Analysts say if big-ticket items stalled in Congress this past year, the outlook for 2020 is even grimmer, as Washington sets its sights on the November elections. Carolyn Presutti, VOA News, at the U.S. Capitol.
Holocaust survivors gathered at the Western Wall in Jerusalem Monday to mark the second day of the Jewish holiday of Hanukkah. AP correspondent Shelley Adler reports.
In addition to gathering at the Western Wall, hundreds of Holocaust survivors are also taking part in a candle lighting of the Hanukkah menorah in New York, Munich, and Moscow. Colette Avital is the chairperson of the Center of Holocaust Survivor Organizations in Israel on why they gather.
To try to make the Holocaust survivors, those who are with us here today, to bring them some light into their lives.
The eight-day Festival of Light symbolizes the triumph of light over darkness and of democracy over tyranny. I'm Shirley Antler.
Well, for the first time since 1803, the iconic Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris will not be holding Christmas Mass. A fire nearly destroyed the iconic UNESCO World Heritage Site, and now it is still undergoing assessment as to whether the cathedral can be saved and safe for the public to enter. The fire destroyed the Gothic spire, the roof, and many irreplaceable artifacts. Officials also say the blaze in April spewed dozens of tons of toxic lead dust into the atmosphere, and there's no threshold for them to gauge how dangerous the potentially deadly pollution was from the dust that settled on the ground. Joining us now from Paris is reporter Catherine Field. Catherine, this is just super sad.
It's a very, very sad day. I think suddenly Paris is realizing that Notre Dame is out of action and she'll be out of action for a long time. There was this idea that perhaps somehow there would be a mass, perhaps a Christmas mass, but there's nothing. What we're seeing now is 8 months after that fire, the structure is still too unstable for anyone to go in. There's a risk of lead poisoning. And all that they can do is say, look, we will let you know by the middle of 2020 whether we can save this cathedral. That's all they're working on at the moment, is just going through that cathedral stone by stone to see how much damage has been done and whether or not it can be saved.
This building, of course, has remained open for Christmas through, what is it, two centuries of history where there was a lot of turmoil, including the Nazi occupation in the Second World War.
Indeed, two world wars, and it still stayed open. Notre Dame was, it's more than just a cathedral. It's the place where the nation comes together. It's a place where the nation celebrates. It's where the nation picks itself up. It's a place where the nation looks after one another, heals one another. So the idea that it made it through two world wars, it made it through the Franco-Prussian War, and it was really just that 1 year in 1803 during a very turbulent anti-Catholic period that followed the French Revolution, that's the only time that it's been closed. So even though they've managed to put the floodlights outside so you can see it lit up at night, it's a very sad building in lots of ways because it's not open. All the stained glass windows have been removed. They've been taken somewhere else to be restored. People are being kept way back. You can't get within 100 meters of the building. And this is a reminder that the heart of Paris is still there, but no one can go near it.
Do they plan to still hold the midnight mass somewhere else?
There will be a midnight mass nearby. There are many churches nearby. Notre Dame, that central part of Paris, has got a lot of churches, but in fact it will just be another parish church nearby that the parishioners of Notre Dame in lots of ways say that they feel as though they're always going from church to church. Whichever church will have them in the area, that's where they're going.
All right. Paris-based reporter Catherine Field, thank you so much for being with us. You're listening to International Edition. We'll be back in a minute.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bantu.
Voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about,
sharing stories of development and growth across Africa,
around the world, and in our lives.
Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, nearly 116 million Americans will travel this holiday season, according to AAA, and more than 104 million of them will be driving. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
It's a tale of two couples as veteran drivers Liz and Jack Faulkner make another yearly trip from the east end of Long Island to Rochester and then Florida before heading back up north for New Year's Eve.
Now we know the back roads.
We know all the back roads. We've been, yeah.
And we don't like paying tolls.
Well, we have to, but we don't always take 90, 95. We know a lot of other ways to go, but he's a great driver.
Meanwhile, there's Lindsay and Brett Roque on their way from Connecticut to Pennsylvania.
Any advice for driving during the holidays?
Don't drive with your husband.
Don't drive with your wife, I was going to say, actually.
At the Alexander Hamilton rest stop off the New Jersey Turnpike, I'm Julie Walker.
Well, climate change has been on the minds of a lot of people But this past year, it has been especially on the minds of musicians, too. In fact, it was a year that saw them use their platform to speak out. One of the most notable, 18-year-old singer, Billie Eilish, who recently talked about her climate anxiety and about eating meat and why she's vegan.
You know why the Amazon is burning? It's because to make cattle farms, to raise cows and kill them for people to eat, they used to chop down trees to make lots of room in any forest. And because that got outlawed, people start fires in forests to make room. It just bothers me because I think people are fake caring about it. Because people don't actually know about it. Like, the week that picture went around of the Amazon burning, that, like, beautiful, horrible picture, and everyone was posting it, I remember seeing, like, all my friends post it, everybody I've ever known posted it. And I just sat there thinking, like, you didn't even do the research on why it's burning. Do you know why the Amazon is burning? It's because to make cattle farms, to raise cows and kill them for people to eat, they used to chop down trees to make lots of room in any forest. And because that got outlawed, people start fires in forests to make room. That's not happening on its own. It's literally people making fires to burn down the trees. They're getting what they want. It's not like it's an accident. They did it on purpose. And then they're making room so they can have cattle farms, raise cows, abuse them, kill them, put them on your plate, and then you take one bite and you walk away, and then you post a picture. Oh, my God.
Eilish wore an oversized T-shirt that said, quote, "No music on a dead planet," during her performance at the American Music Awards. Can't commit to anything but a quarter. Peter's on vacation, an open invitation. You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day. All the good girls go to hell, 'cause even God herself has enemies, and once the water starts to rise, and heaven's out of sight, she'll want the devil on her team. My Lucifer is lonely. Look at you, needing me. You know I'm not your friend without some greenery. Walking wearing feathers, Peter should know better. Your cover-up is caving in. Man is such a fool, why are we saving him? Poisoning themselves now, begging for our help. Wow, those burn in California. My turn to ignore ya. Don't say I didn't run ya. All the good girls go to hell, 'cause even God herself has enemies. And once the water starts to rise, and heaven's out of sight, she'll want the devil on her team. My Lucifer is lonely. There's nothing left to say. My God has done it all. There's nothing left to say.
Hello, this is James Butte, Managing Editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa Show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest Africa news, features, and thoughts. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. That's Daybreak Africa right here on VOA Africa.
Sleeping, yeah. tippy toes creeping around like no one knows. Think you're so criminal.